We are back now to continue with our ongoing series of the Fixed Income Roundtable with the UBS Chief Investment Office Fixed Income Team. We are joined today by Sadiq Mukherjee, Letty Zimaitis, Barry McAlinden, and Frank Saleo. Leading today's roundtable, our moderator, glad to welcome back Leslie Falconio, Head of Taxable Fixed Income Strategy for the Americas. So, everyone, thank you for spending some time with our listeners today. Leslie, let me now turn it over to you to lead today's roundtable.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate that. Well, these are very interesting times, and I'm particularly excited about this roundtable, just given that not only given what everything that's going on, but particularly such a quick shift in sentiment that we have witnessed within the fixed income market. And as we know, the fixed income market likes to speculate, and it is very forward-looking. But when you think about where we were in February, the concerns the market was facing, you know, whether it was AI disruption or credit, this slower growth mentality really started to seep into the marketplace. I mean, we ended February with the 10-year at around a 3.95. The market was pricing in 60 basis points of cuts. It had this terminal rate, or what the market viewed as a neutral rate, if you will, at about a 2.92. Lo and behold, you know, 2.5 weeks later, right, we have interest rates up, you know, anywhere from 40 to 50 basis points. We have the market, you know, putting that slower growth concern completely on the back burner and really focusing on inflation expectations, which has, you know, adjusted the market's expectation of what they believe the Fed will do. And what I mean by that is that not only have they taken out the cuts, but they actually are pricing in a hike. Now, this kind of shift in sentiment, particularly over a very short period of time, can be headwinds for fixed income, as we know, right? It's not just about, you know, you've had interest rates rise 45 basis points. It's different if it rises 45 basis points over 12 months versus 2.5 weeks. So that's why I think this is so great. We have our experts and our specialists on today, and I think the majority of this call, or the goal of this call, is to really guide our investors in terms of how these shifts have impacted certain sectors and where we think about these sectors might play out going forward. So first and foremost, I want to start off with Sadiq. Sadiq, thanks so much. I know that you recently had the Muni Market Guide, which is always a really great publication, you know, for investors to read, but we have both been faced with, you know, a shift in market that is sometimes difficult to catch up. But I want to just get your take on what has the recent performance been in the muni market? How has it shifted from February to March, if at all? And what are you thinking about for the next, say, quarter as we head into still a little bit of a volatile market?
Sure. Thanks, Leslie, for having me on the call. It's really a great discussion and a good opportunity to kind of lay out what the muni market is doing for our clients and advisors. So let me just start with saying that, firstly, the broad theme of the catch-up trade that we highlighted in the 2026 outlook, despite all the shift narratives that you just outlined, that catch-up trade is still working. It's still unchanged. Munis underperformed. The background is munis underperformed other fixed income assets in 2025, significantly so. And we said that relative performance will improve in 2026. So year to date, yes, the muni index is posting a small negative return, total return, but they're still outperforming treasuries, corporates, and the U.S. broad market indices. So that outperformance is continuing, and we maintain our stance on that relative outperformance for the full year, and even more so if you take the tax exemption of the coupon income into consideration. And that is happening despite elevated supply trends continuing this year, and that was expected. So on the issue of relative outperformance and supply being elevated, there is really no change despite these shifting narratives in the fixed income market. The other dynamic we did expect is some market weakness during periods when rate volatility meets weaker technicals. And that is exactly what we saw recently. By technicals, I mean demand-supply balance, often measured in net supply numbers. So even that has happened, we still remain a little cautious in the very near term, given still elevated rate volatility and still and the tax season selling could intensify. So the latest data shows flows have moderated from the very strong levels that fueled the January effect. That has moderated, but reinvestment demand is expected to pick up later in the spring. So if spring is here, summer cannot be far behind. And if that coincides with a more supportive rate environment, that would be a tailwind for the market. As you mentioned, Leslie, treasury yields have moved fairly quickly and significantly over a short period of time. So for munis, with respect to curve and duration, over the last 1 month, yields have increased across the curve. But intermediates have been pressured a little more. That's an interesting dynamic here. That's a section of the curve that was really outperforming with the January effect. And a lot of the SMA demand was going into those intermediate maturities. They got quite rich, and issuers took some advantage by shifting supply into that part of the curve. That coincided with rate volatility, and intermediates have underperformed. Those pressures could remain elevated in the near term. We remain barbelled in the 1 to 3 and 12 to 17 years. We're still not targeting the very long end. The curve remains very steep, especially in the 10 to 30 area. Long end yields now have edged towards the higher end of their 3-year range. So opportunities for extending duration could arise in the near term if you see some more tax-related selling. On credit, fundamentals remain solid. 70% of the bonds in the index are rated AA and above. That's a 15-year high. That provides a ballast for countering any economic surprises to the downside. Fortunately, munis are not directly impacted by AI disruption or private credit concerns, as really finance long-dated essential public infrastructure. But we do acknowledge some spread widening risks, especially if oil prices stay high and the narrative shifts to more of a growth concern story. But the expectation, our expectation still remains trend line growth, which should be a supportive factor. Lastly, and probably most importantly, tax equivalent yields at 6.3% for investors in the top federal tax bracket. That's very attractive at around the 85th percentile over the last 10 years. And that implies a 210 basis point and 114 basis point TEY spread over treasuries and the investment grade corporate index. That spread to the IG index is almost double the 10-year average. So munis are cheap from that perspective. So in summary, I would say, given all the shifting narratives, the fast rise in treasury yields, relative outperformance should continue despite elevated supply. Some near-term market weakness could persist if tax season selling intensifies. There is really more headroom in the muni market, given higher starting yields and a steep curve. So from here, our view is fairly constructive. Credit remains resilient, and tax equivalent yields are attractive, which should drive favorable total returns over the longer investment horizons. Let me stop there, Leslie.
Yeah, thank you, Sudeep. And I think just to your point, I mean, we have a situation now where all this volatility, as we talk about, can create opportunity. And as you just aptly pointed out, the tax equivalent yields, particularly in that long end for long-term investors, I think will continue to offer that opportunity that we look for. And now that we have volatility, I'm sure you'll be on top of, you know, continuously finding that relative value. And with that said, I wanted to move over to Barry, who is our investment grade. And Barry, your sector has been, you know, always at least a spotlight for the past several months, simply because everyone's concerned about the supply. And we know that was such the spotlight in February. As I had mentioned, you know, part of this slower growth scenario that the market was pricing in was due to all of this AI disruption and, you know, supply that might come out due to CapEx. But, you know, overall, when we think about how, you know, investment grade is done, given the volatility, it's actually done okay. So how are you viewing or have you shifted your view given the February, March sort of shift in sentiment on investment grade? And how do you think this will perform over the next couple months?
Yeah, thanks, Leslie. So it's been really remarkable, though. The IG index at the end of February was up 1.7%. And as it stands now, as of March 24th, it's down by 0.6%. So you've had over a 2% drawdown in March. But it's been driven by the surge in treasury yields, not so much credit spreads. So, you know, this year we were looking for credit spreads to be widened, but only modestly, not too much. And I think that is what we have seen played out, actually, which is a bit remarkable, you know, given the list of concerns that the market has had to deal with, whether it be private credit headlines, you know, increased issuance, tensions in the Middle East, and just general equity volatility. So IG spreads are only about 2 basis points wider month to date to 88 basis points. On a year-to-date basis, they're about 9 basis points wider. So it really hasn't been a story of rising credit risk premiums. You know, if you just look at IG credit spreads, still generally conveying a benign, you know, market environment, nothing systemic in any way conveyed about those. Think about the 10-year history, historical average of IG spreads is 119 basis points. So you're still well below that. So the value that's been maintained in IG is from the absolute yield that you get from the asset class. And, you know, that was our view headed into the year. It wasn't about the spread. It was about the absolute yield. And now with treasury yields having moved higher this month, you know, we continue to reiterate that view. So you just think about where yields are for the IG index currently. They have risen by 30 basis points this year to 5.1%. And if you break it down by shorter maturity increments, the 1 to 10-year segment yield is 4.8%. The 1 to 5-year is 4.6. So you have quite attractive absolute yields, especially not that short end, that 1 to 5-year area of the curve. So, you know, our recommendation is really intact, and that's, you know, investors with excess cash holdings should consider locking in yields into these kind of medium tenor IG bonds, especially, you know, at these higher 4% type yield levels for single A's and 5% for triple B's. You think about the yield pickup that's provided over 3-month treasury bills at currently at 3.6%. So, you know, that's quite attractive. And, you know, as you mentioned, we don't agree with the view that the market is pricing in hikes. And in fact, we think the next Fed action is likely to be a cut. So if anything, that treasury bill yield, we think, is going to move lower, not higher. You mentioned the supply, you know, has been very robust this year for investment grade corporates. In fact, we're on pace now with gross issuance about $600 billion year to date. We could reach that $2 trillion market on a full year basis, you know, which would be a new record. I think if you dissect it down, though, you know, coming into the year, we thought that the hyperscaler technology segment of the market, that issuance is going to be strong there. And in fact, it has been. We've seen the main U.S. hyperscalers have issued about $110 billion so far this year. $82 billion of that has been in the U.S. dollar market and $28 billion in other currencies. So they haven't necessarily just solely relied on the U.S. dollar market, I think, which has been a positive development for investors being able to more readily digest, you know, what's come to market. So, yeah, hyperscaler issuance has been strong, but, you know, investors weren't expecting this coming into the year. I think two areas of new issuance that's actually surprised has been the banks. We thought that the U.S. banks would actually slow down a bit on their primary deals because of the regulation incentivizes them to hold like less long-term debt for resolution purposes. That has not played out year-to-date. You know, they've issued quite a bit. Year-to-date tally is about $65 billion in the U.S. dollar market. I think, you know, various reasons for that, I won't get into the details, but that's been an area that's surprised to the upside in terms of new issue volume. And then the M&A category, too. You know, again, we thought this is going to be higher this year just because of the pipeline of deals that needed bond funding. And so far, if you tally up primary deals for M&A-related purposes, it's about $100 billion, you know, of that $600 billion. And that included a $20 billion multi-tranche deal from Abbott Labs and a $16 billion multi-tranche deal from Honeywell Aerospace. So, yes, primary market expectations are, you know, holding up the way we thought, but I think the composition is maybe a little bit different than what we expected. But, you know, to sum things up for investment grade corporates, we do like the absolute yield that's attainable in the market. I think our view for yields, again, are going to be, I think, driven by the trajectory of what happens in U.S. government bonds, treasuries, more so than spreads. You know, we're still expecting generally range-bound credit spread environment, kind of around these 90 basis point level for the IG index. So definitely find investment-grade corporates to be, you know, an appealing place to capture that high quality, you know, kind of in that 4 to 7 year part of the curve where now you can get yields that are, you know, close to 5%. I could stop there, Leslie, and turn it back to you.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. That was a really great summation. And, you know, we're surprised as well. And I think the M&A activity and particularly the issuance and financials are very strong points. And, you know, one thing to note about things such as investment grade, besides the compounding income and the higher quality, I mean, you can see this, the flows of the investment grade have continued, right? We've had some, disparity maybe in the lower credit quality, and we'll talk about that a bit later, but you've had a pretty good consistent inflow with IG, and it remains an asset class that we think still has value, particularly given some of the volatility. We like the higher quality, but again, you need to pick your points on the curve and also be opportunistic about taking advantage when we have a shift in performance, Barry, like you had mentioned. So thanks very much. Now, Frank, I want to go over to you in preferreds because, you know, you, like yourself, I feel as we look at rates going down and up, there's been a bit of volatility within that preferred sector, as one might anticipate, given the volatility that we've seen within rates, within equity. You know, it's expected to see this kind of volatility within the preferred market. But I want to sort of get your take on how you view preferreds in today's environment. Are you surprised by some of the changes that have occurred, and how do you see it performing over the next couple months?
Yeah, thanks, Leslie. For sure, performance-wise, investors have been on a roller coaster ride of concerns, as you mentioned. The latest source of worry, of course, has been the Iran war that began at the start of the month, and the related spike in oil prices and the economic inflationary ramifications of that. But before that, as you mentioned, investors were focused on potential BDC and private credit losses, AI disruption, as you mentioned, and also concerns around U.S. fiscal deficits and debt sustainability. So all of these concerns collectively have had ripple effects across all financial markets, all asset classes and sectors, both equity and fixed income. And most high-quality fixed income sectors are down so far in March by about 2%, give or take. You know, Barry just mentioned IG, but you know, most high-quality fixed income sectors are down in predominantly driven by the backup in treasury yields. When it comes to preferreds, the $25 par preferreds, the retail preferreds, which started the year, you know, strong out of the gate, they have now given up all of their year-to-date gains. They're posting a marginal loss for the year now. Specifically, retail preferreds were one of the top performing sectors in January. They had a 1 month gain of 1.9%, which is very strong for 1 month, but they are so far one of the worst performers in March. They're down by almost 3%. You know, one of the worst performers, especially relative to high quality fixed income, as I mentioned, which is down around 2%, give or take. And it underscores a topic that I've been harping on really for the past several months, and that is that the $25 par retail preferred sector is a fundamentally different sector than it was just 5 years ago. It's a much more volatile sector. It's a much more interest rate sensitive sector and more sensitive to equity volatility. And we see it again with performance so far in just the first 3 months of the year. And it's especially evident when we compare the performance of the $25 par preferreds to that of the $1,000 par preferreds. Year to date, both retail and institutional preferreds are posting a marginal loss, but those $25 par retail preferreds had a much more volatile pathway to where we are today. We had that 1% gain in January and now nearly a 3% loss in March. Meanwhile, the $1,000 pars had a smaller gain in January, and so far they've had a smaller loss in March. Bottom line, less volatility from the institutional $1,000 par preferreds. And at times, the $1,000 par preferreds with their variable rate coupons can be a good hedge against volatility, especially during periods of extreme uncertainty like we're experiencing now. And this is the topic of the latest monthly update to the Preferred Securities Top Picks Report, which I just published. The latest edition is entitled, Are You Diversified? And in the latest report, I highlight that the low rate backdrop back in 2020 and 2021 and the related refinancing boom during that period fundamentally altered the character of retail preferreds. Many issuers back then refinanced and replaced their older preferreds with newer fixed coupons set at historic lows, and that made the group much more sensitive to interest rates, and it added to the group's already higher correlation to the stock market versus the institutional preferreds. So for retail preferreds, if we look at the standard deviation of monthly returns over the past 5 years, it jumped to 3.7% from 1.4% sequentially in the prior 5 year period. For institutional preferreds, volatility showed a smaller increase to 2% from 1.2%. So, putting it all together, I continue to recommend that investors incorporate an allocation to $1,000 par preferred recommendations. $1,000 par preferreds can be a powerful diversifier for your fixed income allocation, but not all preferred funds, not all preferred ETFs invest in the space, so consider individual security recommendations as well, individual $1,000 par preferred security recommendations. But listen, it's important to note, investors should also maintain a meaningful exposure to the $25 par sector as well, because the high quality and long duration bias of the $25 par retail preferred should perform well if we slip into a sustained flight to quality scenario, if we have that type of a tail risk situation unfolding. In terms of outlook, retail preferreds, as you mentioned, very highly volatile this month in particular. They will continue to face headwinds as long as economic recession risks and possible growth scare pressures stocks, and as long as inflation risks and higher rates pressure bonds. If stocks and bonds are both under pressure, preferreds will get dragged down too because they're tied to both. On the other hand, we could see a rally once it becomes clear that the Middle East situation is resolving and the oil markets are normalizing. From a valuation perspective, clearly valuation has improved. You're 100% right, Leslie. We've got to be opportunistic about this and look for these tactical opportunities during these periods of heightened volatility. Retail preferred yields have risen more than the yields on 5- and 10-year treasuries. So those yield premiums are now at or above the 5-year median. So investors should also look to opportunistically add to exposure with individual $25 par recommendations. You can find yields of 6% or more from these high quality preferreds, or the preferreds from these high quality issuers. In many cases, they're also tax advantaged because the coupons are considered QDI eligible. And if the crisis is resolved soon, and if we see credit spreads broadly begin to tighten again, and importantly, if we begin to see Fed cuts get priced back in, as you mentioned at the outset, that we've kind of flip-flopped and did a 180 and started pricing in hikes. But if we get Fed cuts priced back into the market, we're set up for a strong rebound from retail preferreds. So I'd recommend that investors check out the Preferred Securities Top Picks report for our latest top pick list of both $25 par and $1,000 par preferred recommendations and specific ideas. And Leslie, I'll turn it back over to you.
Okay, Frank, thanks so much. I appreciate that. And, you know, you're right. I mean, listen, the correlations that we've seen with the preferred market, when you have this kind of volatility, can sometimes break down. And this is what can happen when there's uncertainty, when there's volatility, and volatility within the treasury market and or the equity market, that sometimes those sectors that do have embedded interest rate risk and yields go down just are not quite performing as one would think, simply because the uncertainty and volatility is so high. But as you mentioned, as you know, growth slows, as by the way, We're not looking for a recession. We are looking for growth to slow in the second half of the year, which is why we have these cuts priced in, our expectation of two cuts. You know, it could be a good sector to earn some incremental income and get the benefit of that interest rate component. So thanks very much. And with that said, Letty, you're going to round that up, and we're going to end with you on a great, on an important topic in the sense of what we're seeing in the like high yield loan market. You wrote the lead for the last fixed income strategist. You did a great job. So I'm really curious of what your thoughts are there, what you think, how has anything changed from the, as I mentioned, the February AI disruption going to slow growth story, which has now switched to, oh my gosh, now we have inflation story in the month of March. How do you sort of see this performance shifting, and what's your outlook for the next couple months? Thank you.
Yeah, so my two sectors actually have flip-flopped. So I'll start with high yield. So when we were having all that AI disruption, high yield was basically resilient due to its low exposure to the software sector, which is only 4%. So for year-to-date of February, we were up in high yield. It was up 65 basis points. And then come March, once we had the Iran conflict, we saw negative performance within high yield. Now, it's been mostly tied to rates as spreads have barely moved. If you look at for the month of March, spreads have only widened 9 bips, which is nothing. So when we, and the duration within high yield is very short, 3 years. So when we look at the 2 to 3 year treasury yields go up, you know, within the last few weeks, 50 bips, which is significant, that's really what drew the negative performance in high yields. It's not the fundamental high yields asset class. The credit metrics are very strong. We did see issuance very subdued this month. It was doing really well in January and February, but we only saw, you know, $15 billion, and just this week we had one issuer, NextArk, issue for $5 billion. So that's, you know, we have, it's been more risk off due to all the, you know, uncertainty. When we look within high yield, as expected, the higher quality has performed better. The double Bs and single B, triple Cs is actually down 1.8 for the month. Within sectors, the top performing, no surprises, energy. Energy is up 2.4. And this is all just, you know, with the fears if we have higher oil prices, we'll have higher inflation and lower our growth. So that's the high yield story. With that, we have seen yields much higher. They're at 7.5. They went down after Trump spoke, and there's talks that they might be improving with the de-escalation news. We did see yields drop then to 7.4, but it's still very attractive, you know, for high yield. Valuations also, we sort of go down 2 points. We were at $98 prior to the Iran crisis. Now we're at 96. All of this doesn't really change our view on high yield. We still feel it's a good story. We're expect default rates are at 1%. We're thinking maybe they may touch 2%. But so fundamentally, we don't have any change in our views. We remain neutral. We just have to be more cautious. It's going to be more opportunistic, as you know, previous speakers have spoken. Due to the volatility, it may be a good time to start taking a look at high yield, especially at this high, you know, due to the high, pun, you know, high yield, because what, if this does become a shorter conflict and short-lived, we will see those yields come down. So therefore, once the treasuries come down, we will see the yields in high yields come down. So that would be, you know, a very opportunistic point. Now, for loans, at the beginning of the year, they were actually negative. So when we look at January, February, they were down 1% due to the AI disruption concerns. And if you want to, you know, read further about that, please read our fixed income strategist lead. We go into a lot of detail about how it could impact the credit markets. So that became a risk-off sentiment. We saw within the software sector, it was down 7% within loans. Loans have has a higher software exposure than high yield to 14%. So it, you know, it did really impact them. We saw spreads widening about 60 bips within the overall loan index. But then now that, you know, we are, all the focus is on Iran, people were thinking maybe they were a little bit, it was too much about, you know, the negative sentiment on loans. We have seen prices starting to stabilize. It has a very attractive yield of 8.5%. We don't see fundamentals deteriorating in the loan sector. Our forecast still remains the same as the beginning of the year, 3 to 5%. If we do get the lower Fed cuts, that's going to help the issuers, as since it's a floating rate, their interest coverage will go down, so that'll be beneficial for them. We're expecting a default rate between 3 to 4. We're at 3.4 right now. We don't expect and anticipate any rise in defaults. What will be vulnerable and sensitive to AI disruption is software sector. Yes, that's the one. We do have a dispersion within sectors, and that's the one that you know, is to watch, is how the software sector is in loans. But also issuance was much stronger in January for loans, but then, you know, it's been a little bit lighter February and March. But overall, you know, we have a view of neutral on both sectors. Like I mentioned, they flip-flopped as of late, but we don't, fundamentals are strong. You know, we're still having issuance. Spreads not crazy. It's still, you know, very minimal, the spread widening that we're seeing. It's just, it's mostly what we're seeing is rates has been impacting them. And of course, the Iran conflict is a risk off sentiment that's hurting high yield. Back to you, Leslie.
Thanks, Leslie. I appreciate that. And, you know, one of the things about high yield as well, and this goes for IG too. I mean, they're both at, what, 9 months high in spread and yield. And as you mentioned, you know, the carry component to drive the total return with high yield is obviously very important. I mean, we are positioned more for the higher quality. We want to wait to see whether or not when this conflict does get resolved, or even just to see the pace of escalation come down, whether or not the market shifts back to AI disruption. But overall, you know, we still like high quality, but I think that there's opportunities, or will be opportunities going forward, in the more credit embedded sectors, such as, you know, high yield and loans. So thank you so much for listening. This is where we stand today, and there is a lot going on. I really appreciate all of the commentary from our sector specialists. I think it's great. And hopefully this acts as a good guide in terms of diversifying your portfolio, not having too much concentration in a particular risk, and just having a view or a feeling about what our outlook is for the next several months. I mean, we're in an environment where sentiment is shifting quickly. You know, we don't want to make short-term moves. We are in these investments for, we stay invested for the longer term. You know, volatility does create opportunity, and we'll react on that opportunity. But overall, short-term reactions to these kind of sentiment shifts is not a strategy that we would advise. So thanks very much, everyone, for tuning in, and we'll see you in a bit. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.